Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 129 of Registry Matters. Larry, before too long, man, we are going to catch up to your age and we're going to pass you.
I doubt that.
You don't think so? Are you counting your age by weeks, same as we're doing the podcast?
Well, you've got about another 100 to go before you catch up in years.
I think so. Larry, I made a couple phone calls this week. Can you believe that?
No, I'd have to see verification on your phone log.
You wouldn't believe me if I just told you that I actually picked up and I dialed digits and received somebody on the other side?
No, I would not. I could not comprehend such a thing.
I could probably get evidence inside the chat room, like with a person, like calling them on the spot to prove it. Would you believe it then?
Only a phone log will do. A screenshot of your phone outgoing log would do.
Oh, what? Okay, I'll send you one. Truth be told, Larry, I really, really dislike making phone calls.
I'm quite well aware of that. You would prefer to spend 3 days in electronic exchanges rather than solving something could be solved in a minute and a half of the conversation.
That's possibly true, but I could be doing other things at the same time while I'm texting.
So, and that's the way that things have evolved. People will stretch out something that could be solved in a quick chat over days and days.
Well, how are you on this Saturday?
Fantastic. This is a holiday weekend that's very significant to our nation because of what it represents.
And what does it represent?
Well, it's a memorialization of those who have given their all and served. And
that's
you've
right.
Served, but I'm not sure you gave your all.
I gave everything I had at the time. Truth be told, 1,000 years ago, I was a musician in the Navy, and this was a very, very busy weekend where we would go from, cemetery to cemetery to cemetery to play ceremonies for people.
And how many years ago was that?
It would have been the early 90s. It was pretty much during the Gulf War. I like served during the exact same time of the Gulf War, but I was stationed in New Orleans, and there was a lot of Mardi Gras.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yep. Do we have anything exciting going on tonight on the podcast?
I hope we do. We have a YouTube commenter that we're going to address on the podcast, and we've got breaking news, and we've got an important case decided in Tennessee, and we've got dozens and dozens of people in Tennessee listening, waiting to hear our analysis, so it's going to be fun.
Do you want to do the comment first?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So you found this. I didn't actually notice it, but a person over on the YouTube channel, which you can find at youtube.com/registrymatters. It says, a questioner says, what if you're required to register in your original state and then you move to a state that because of the same wording, they require you to register? Did I get all the words in there? Did I miss that you're not required to register in your original state? Yeah. So you're in state A and you are not required to register. And then you move to state B and they say, well, because you committed a felony jaywalking, which I know you hate, but hey, that's similar here. So now you have to register.
That is a scenario that happens. And again, this is a great question because each state defines what's the scope of their registry. And some states have much broader lists. And all you have to do is go look at those lists. And then some states, of course, have the catch-all language that you're required to register anywhere. You're required to register there. But this is not his question. His question is, if you were to be in a state that has a narrower list of offenses and you were to move. Now, for the sake of the question, we're going to pretend that the person wasn't under supervision in the state that didn't require them to register, because that would change my answer considerably. If you were under supervision.
So they're post-probation, post-parole.
Or yes, because if you're under supervision, the supervising authorities are going to hand you off to be supervised in the other state. If you're going to a state where you're not registered to a state where you might conceivably have to register, that's a whole different analysis because you don't know. You know that you have a conviction. Most people are not running around with convictions that they don't know about. So you generally know you have a conviction. But if you've never been required to register, what you could do is you could do like Mr. McGuire did, who was never required to register in Colorado. When he moved back to his home in Alabama, you could go knock on the sheriff's door and you could say, well, I don't have to register, but you guys do have a registry and I'm just checking. And then that's how he ended up on the registry, which that case is still pending in the 11th Circuit because it hasn't been fully adjudicated. But But if you were to just simply move from a state you didn't have to register, unless you're spewing that radiation that we talk about, they wouldn't know you were there, right? How would they know that you're there? So the answer is that you wouldn't have to register until they told you that you did have to register, because it would not be reasonable for you to think you have to register when you never had to register. So therefore, unless you ran into an officer who had the reason to do a background check that wanted to go beyond just a standard search for warrants, you might live for a very, very long time. Where if you get arrested, they typically run a full background check through AFIS and every database they've got. So if you got arrested for something, they would probably discover the offense in the original state, and they might send it to be analyzed by their people to say, I think this is a sex offense, because by the name it might look like a sex offense. So the answer is, yes, you could have to register, but realistically, you might go a very long time before you have to.
But wouldn't there be consequences for you not registering?
I don't think so. If you didn't know you had such a duty, you wouldn't have had it. Most of the states have a knowing requirement that you have to know that you're required to register. If you were never required to register, how would you know? Because you never been served the duty, a notice of a duty to register. How would you know that?
Is this, we touched on it just briefly last week, the dude in North Carolina, is that Muniz? Is that the person that moved to the state? Is that the right person?
No, you're thinking about the Muniz is from Pennsylvania, but the guy in North Carolina that moved from
a couple counties and then it's like, hey, do you have to register? No. And then they catch him. Isn't that similar to what we're talking about then?
Yes. Yes. The case is escaping me. But he had a duty to register in the state that he started in.
Okay. So that's the difference there.
That's the difference. If you're being handed off, they're going to know.
Yeah, sure.
But if you're going in unregistered, you wouldn't have ever thought that you had a duty to register if you were never notified if you had a duty. And this would be a good time to touch on, we had the guest, we had Joshua Ho a few weeks back, and I can never keep track of the episodes. But he talked about strict liability, and the way his attorney explained it to him is not what strict liability means at all. Strict liability doesn't mean that there are no defenses, which is what Josh said. A strict liability offense is one where that there isn't the requisite state of mind knowing, mens rea or scienter, S-C-I-E-N-T-E-R, which is really pronounced center. But a person who has never had to register wouldn't have knowledge of a duty to register. And most of the states require that you knowingly be in violation of the registry. If you read the statute, it says you shall not knowingly be on a park or playground where children congregate. You shall not knowingly do these things. And a strict liability offense would be like what we talked about, drug possession in the state of Florida, which was found to be unconstitutional by a federal court and subsequently was found to be constitutional by the state court. The possession of drugs is a strict liability offense, almost, not completely, because it does have an affirmative defense, which you can assert saying, yes, you didn't know that they were drugs, but the burden on an affirmative defense shifts to you, the accused, to show that a reasonable person would not believe when you kill a person in self-defense, that's an affirmative defense. You say, yes, I shot the MF-er, but I did it because of this. And I did it because of this, and a reasonable person would have acted similarly in the circumstances because he was 275 pounds, all bulked up, and he was coming at me as fast as he could run, and I'm 60 years old and I can't run. And when I looked at that situation, I thought the only way to save myself was to kill him. And that has to be the fact finder has to conclude that that was a reasonable action in view of the totality of the circumstances. That's an affirmative defense. So a strict liability offense is not one where there are no defenses. It's where there's not a particular state of knowledge required for the state to prevail. And strict liability offenses are largely unconstitutional.
When you get pulled over for speeding and you go, sorry, I didn't know the speed limit says ignorance of the law is no excuse, is that sort of describing strict liability?
That is, and that is the exception, because minor regulatory offenses where the penalties are not huge and the stigma for a long period of time or a lifetime isn't there. Speeding is a true strict liability offense. We don't care. If somebody took the sign down, I mean, a traffic judge might would consider it if you could show that the sign was down or it was covered by trees. But you we don't really care because it doesn't stigmatize you for a long period. The fine is $35. You get a point on your ticket or a couple of points, and you're on with your life. So those type of strict liability, regulatory and minor infractions are allowed to be strict liability, but those crimes that carry significant penalties can't be strict liability.
All right. I met somebody while I was gone who alleges that he wakes up in the middle of the night and his daughter was having a slumber party and one of his daughter's friends was there with him. Not going to go into any graphic details. He didn't know what was going on. He thought it was his girlfriend that had come home from work late. He doesn't, quote unquote, know. I don't care about whether he's lying or what. Do not care. Is that, like, I didn't know. The lights were out. This was going on. What are you supposed to do?
Well, I think we'd need just a tad bit more details.
Probably.
Just a tad bit more.
But even still, like you go to a club and everyone gets carded going into the club. So you make the assumption that they were carding everybody going to the club. So everybody has to be over 18. Lo and behold, somebody got in with a fake ID. You didn't know. You could assume that everybody there was legal. How do you get jammed up? Like, I didn't know. Are you supposed to check everybody's ID when you try to go home with them later?
Unfortunately, for sexual offenses, for age as a deciding factor, the law is not as good as it should be. The case law that's developed has not been spectacular. I believe it's wrong, but it's wrong until the Supreme Court says it's right. And okay. there was a footnote in a decision in the Supreme Court called the Morissetti, except there's a footnote in a case. And everybody has decided from the Morissetti footnote, from a case that's decades old, that it's permissible to have strict liability when it comes to sexual offenses. The Supreme Court never said that. They merely observed in that footnote that some courts had decided to dispense with the knowledge requirement. In fact, through subsequent many decisions since Morissetti, they have said the opposite. They've said that knowledge, mens rea, scienter is required. They've said it over and over again. But the reason why we haven't been able to overturn this is because we haven't had the right case that's made its way up through the process to get to the Supreme Court, particularly on point where someone has good facts. Whether that person who told you that story has good facts or not, I don't know. I don't know if the person was 9 years old, the person was 15 years old. I don't know if the guy particularly has a spouse that he would be expected to come home at that time of night, and if it would be a reasonable thing to say that someone as a stranger could hop in my bed and I would just assume that it was my spouse and I wouldn't ask any questions. I mean, I don't know. There's just too many unknowns here to know whether that would be a viable defense. I'd have to look at the totality, all the evidence, the credibility of the accuser, the credibility of the accused, because you would almost have to put the accused on the stand in that particular situation. That's the only way I can see to get that in, because when you're asserting an affirmative defense saying, yeah, I did it, yeah, I did whatever those facts are that you want to go into, but I thought it was my spouse. What if the spouse weighs 350 pounds and the person who made the accusation was 110 pounds and very firm? It wouldn't take too long where you would quickly realize that was just your spouse, I would assume, right?
Just dreaming. Yes, I understand. That's a funny point you bring up. I didn't consider that at the time.
And if the shoe was on the other foot, I mean, this is not gender bias. I mean, if it's a woman saying that, I mean, guys also get big pot bellies and they get a lot hairier as they get older. And if a 15-year-old guy's in the bed with you, and most of them are usually pretty smooth bodied, and you're rubbing your hands over, it wouldn't take you too long to realize that this isn't what I'm used to feeling when I'm in bed. I mean, I might ought to just do a little bit further check here.
You're too funny, man. All right. So bottom line is you probably would be okay going to another state from which you didn't have to register. And this isn't a podcast that gives legal advice. So don't take this as legal advice, but you probably don't tell them. I'm not saying you don't have to, just don't tell them.
Well, I can only speak for myself. If I didn't have to register, I cannot conceive of any situation I would knock on a registration door and ask, do I have to register here? I can't fathom any circumstance that I would do that. But each person has their... Go ahead.
Well, so somebody recently was removed from the registry in a state, and they had some business to tend to in Florida. So they went to Florida, and they spent like 4 days in Florida? and they just zipped in, did their thing, and they zipped out and were there longer than the time frame, and like kind of like, you know, heart beating through the whole thing, you know, heart elevated, raised and all that stuff. But they didn't go register, and the hovercraft didn't seem to show up.
I was going to ask about the hovercraft. I can't conceive of such a situation that would compel me to go into a registry office and say, do I have to register if I didn't have to register? And particularly if I never had to register, that would be even make it very unlikely, because I don't know how often this person breaks the law that poses the question. But if you're not constantly in barroom brawls like the guy that went from Colorado to Nebraska who messed everything up for the juveniles and got into a brawl that didn't register, if you're not constantly getting DWIs, if you're not constantly encountering the law, you might go the rest of your life and no one know.
I understand. We ready to go on?
Let's do it.
I'm going to get the sound ready before we actually have to play it, Larry. All right. Well, this showed up on the radar earlier this week. This is an individual is allegedly like out washing his car. And, you know, we will never have his side of the story, but somebody said that he was doing something kind of like creepy, I guess. And he decides to just haul off and kill the guy. He was on the registry. And so this is a 43-year-old man named James Fairbanks killed Matteo Condolucci, I think is what it is. And he was on the registry. So he's one of our people. And this is pretty horrible. I don't know how you would just be like, randomly recognize someone from being on the registry. I don't see how you get from A to B in that particular situation right off the bat.
This is one of those tragic in a chain of tragedies of the registry being used for both harassment, violence, and death. And this article is relatively new. The story's been out for a while, but this was the person made their first appearance in court, and they're being held without bond. And the prosecutor's office are bringing the maximum charges that they can bring. So we really don't have a whole lot of complaint about the prosecution here. We don't have a whole lot to complain about the judge. They're holding him with that bond. I mean, you really can't do any more than that.
They wanted 500 grand, and the judge didn't give him bond.
Well, the defense is trying to capitalize on the emotion of the people, which is very favorable. That if you read the story, he got a standing ovation when he went to jail.
Yes. Yes, and he's got all kinds of people putting money on his books and GoFundMe accounts to fund his defense and all that shit.
Now these are people, this is what amazes me about jail. These are people who claim that they believe that jailers should treat them as innocent. Now, we're talking about jail, not prison. These are people who claim that they believe in innocence, but yet they are applauding a person as if they have been able to pronounce everything on the spot. And they don't know. I mean, I guess what it's really signifying is the people in jail who claim that they are so opposed to unfairness, the fact that this man was deprived of life and liberty and everything without any due process, I suppose it doesn't bother them at all, does it?
It doesn't appear to. And I don't know the guy's history to know whether he committed one offense, 50 offenses. I do not have that. But even the guy's daughter said that he's hurt a lot of people and she's not surprised. And she wants the person that committed the homicide to go free.
That really is disappointing. I mean, she certainly has the right to an opinion that she has, but I can't imagine how you could justify that in a country that's supposed to be governed by the rule of law, that this person, and he was doing what every sex offender gets criticized for doing. You're apparently not supposed to eat out anywhere where there might be children. You're not supposed to shop anywhere where there might be children. You're not supposed to look in a neighbor's yard. Every single person who's interviewed that lives next to a sex offender, they always say they spotted a sex offender looking in their yard. And for the life of me, I don't know how you would see them looking in your yard if you weren't looking in theirs.
Well, you got to keep an eye on them, Larry.
But how
don't you
would
know
you?
That? There's a creepy person living next door. You have to keep your eye on them because they might, I don't know, spontaneously molest people.
So it's rather sad, and we got to get back to the PFRs because we're not supposed to be using this term so loosely, sex offender. But in this particular context, he is dead because he was on the sex offender registry. So I think
the public
that we
part
should,
of it
we,
really
we shouldn't sugarcoat this. Now, he was listed as a sex offender. and he is dead because of the sex offender registry.
And this something that, that we kind of bat around a lot is whether the registry is constitutional or not. And okay, we can go into the nuances of whether it would pass the muster or not. But your record is public, so somebody could go to the courthouse and find out what you were alleged to have done and what you were convicted of and all that. That's public record. But just making it so that it's a super easy Google search, the second or third to last article that we have, the individual's name shows up. When you search for that individual's name, he still shows up as a convicted whatever it says. So you have no opportunity to be quote-unquote forgotten out of this whole thing, ever.
Well, and to add to your point about the, if you went to the courthouse, you might find that the conviction record, but you wouldn't necessarily know where the person lives. See, that's not a part of the conviction, which we'll get into in the case out of Tennessee later about what's wrong with the Tennessee registry. Your conviction is public record. What you drive, where you live, who you're living with, where you work, that isn't a part of your conviction. And that's what the court in Tennessee was able to discern, which is a part of what I've been saying for a long time. The conviction information, yes, is public.
So John Doe committed XYZ crime at this time frame and got sentenced to 20 years in prison. That's correct. Pretty much all that's there.
That's correct. And they could put your mugshot upon your conviction. And that's what I keep telling people. If you want a constitutional registry, here's what you need to do. You tell people, congratulations, you're on the registry. We're going to put a list of your mugshot as of today, the day your judgment's entered, and we're going to put you on this list of called convicted sex offenders. Go on, have a great life. That's constitutional because your address is not on there or your drive, what your drive is not on there, who you're living with. You have no restrictions on who you live with, where you can work. You go on about your life. That would be a very benign and a very constitutional registry. I wouldn't advocate for it, but if you're determined to have one, that's what you need to do to have a constitutional registry.
Like also giving all of your quote unquote internet identifiers to law enforcement.
On and on, which, like I say, we'll get into more with the with the Doe versus Roush out of Tennessee. But this man has been murdered because of the sex offender registry. And to their credit, they're doing the maximum they can now to try to hold him accountable. Unfortunately, Judge Richard Koff in Nebraska, which was the federal judge who heard the challenge in Nebraska's registry, said that people would undoubtedly get hurt. And I don't think he was predicting and clairvoyant thinking that people would be killed in Nebraska. But he knew that this misguided policy that the legislature enacted, that the governor signed back about a decade ago, he knew that there was that people were going to be harmed. But he, as he said, and I used to quote from his opinion, he said that a black robe does not entitle him to undo public policy that's the will of the people. The public policy has to be unconstitutional. Just because it's a bad policy doesn't make it an unconstitutional policy.
What about the second article that you have tied to this, the title, and now that I read it actually like again, from the ex-wife, Omaha man arrested in killing of registered sex offender, fearful man would offend again. So this is worded, I think, to be coherent, is ex-wife is fearful that her ex-husband, the one that is the PFR, would offend again. I mean, isn't that an inflammatory headline?
It is. And the fact of the matter is we can have a fear of a lot of, when we as a society collectively impose the punishment, we can have a fear that you're going to offend again, whatever the offense is. But it doesn't entitle us to do anything to you until you do. And when people ask, what do we do in lieu of the sex offender registry? I tell them the same thing we do with people who sell drugs to children, people who embezzle from their employers, or whatever it is they do. When they do it again, we prosecute them again, but we don't lock them up for what they may do.
And probably with more time associated with it also.
Generally speaking, yes. And a fear is not enough. To trample the Constitution, sure, you might have the fear. There would have to be some really creepy people that engage in sexual offending. I haven't met them personally, but they would have to be out there. There's creepy people who do practically every type of offense. It would stand to reason there would be creepy people who do some really awful things. But once we extract the punishment that the justice system has imposed, we can't continue to punish them. We let them go out and they have the opportunity to make decisions. And if they make bad decisions, we'll deal with them again.
Seems all misguided about the fear. Did you see the message I posted in the email group yesterday regarding fear and vaccinations?
I did. Yes, I sure did.
Did you pay any attention to it? I was just curious. I'm not trying to dig into it. I paid
a lot of attention to it. Yes.
Oh, did you listen to the clip?
I did not do that.
Oh, okay. Well, there was a 6-minute clip that I captured from another podcast where they were talking about the fear that if you vaccinate your kids, all of these XYZ things will happen. Not trying to go down that path. I'm just talking about the fear mongering that is presented from the anti-vaxxers. And on the sort of like inverse, but still sort of the same, the fear on our side is that these persons have done these things. We know that they commit or they were convicted of a thing. They may reoffend. So they have all of the emotional energy behind them. But if you look at it from the side of what have vaccinations done that are good, it's not so emotional. This is totally like a logical fallacy called appeal to emotion. And so in both cases, it's a huge appeal to emotion that drives all kinds of bad decisions on the backside of it. I don't know how we fix it other than that we have to be better at marketing our idea. I don't know how we bridge this huge fear. I mean, you know, it's like the fear of flying. Like if you get in an airplane, you are more likely going to get there safely than if you drive. But the fear of all the fire and the crash, like the media sensationalizes it to the umpteenth degree, but not nearly that many people die in plane crashes that they do in cars.
Well, I think that I don't have the answer, but I have some starting points. And where we would start is that thing that peeves me is when people say, when they ask the person forced to register, aren't you responsible for this? And every single time they always say yes. And every single time they should say no. I'm not responsible for the Constitution being trampled. I'm only responsible for my behavior, which I have paid my debt to society in the case of those who have paid their debt in full. And what society has chosen to do outside constitutional framework, no, I'm not responsible for that. Now, they would probably clip that on the cutting room floor, not run it, but they inevitably always say yes. So someone goes on camera and they always say yes to that question. That's an inevitable question. It must just be a natural, but they ask you, aren't you ultimately responsible for your predicament? You say, no, ma'am, I'm not.
Not for the predicament, but the actions that led you, but not the situation after the fact, I guess.
Yeah, the hardships that when they're talking about, because you'll have occasionally you have a story where they present the hardships of being registered, and then they'll inevitably say, well, aren't you ultimately responsible for this? And you should say, no, I am not. I can't take responsibility for unconstitutional laws that have been made. I didn't do that part of it.
That one takes a little bit to digest, Larry. Just to be honest, the framing of the question almost up front leads you down the path to say, well, yes, I'm responsible. Like no one forced me to do what I did, but that's not the question. You're almost answering, I guess, almost answering a different question than what is being asked, maybe?
I don't think so. If you're complaining that you can't go to see your kids on school plays and you can't go to the PTA, you can't do this and that and the other, and they say, aren't you responsible for that? If you believe that's unconstitutional, you should say, no, I'm not responsible for not being able to do those things. You are.
I get you. It's just the person asking the question is putting all of the pieces there together in one big lump. And the question, I still kind of almost stand that you're answering a different question. And I don't disagree with the way that you're answering it. I don't mean to be speaking it that way. Just that, look, I'm taking responsibility for the actions that I did, but it's all this other garbage that goes with it. No. That's not my responsibility. You have to articulate the differences between the two.
That's too long of a question. And when you answer it with a yes, everything else is going to fall to the cutting room floor. You have to start with no.
I gotcha.
Because with a yes, they've got you.
Yeah. And then they can clip that. So, okay, I'm with you. This is why politicians, they must spend an exorbitant amount of time being schooled on answering questions because they are usually very slick and polished and it's hard to catch them off guard.
Well, I would say that's the case for a number of them, but some are not very polished. We've got some that live on Pennsylvania Avenue that are not all that polished.
Yes, totally. Shall we continue, sir?
Yes.
All right. This article comes from The Appealance. Housing the formerly incarcerated should be a fundamental right, especially in a pandemic. Man, I'm with you on this one. Like, we have people that are being compassionately released, not nearly in enough numbers, but when they get out, they might not have any sort of family support. They may have medical conditions that they have to deal with, whether that's mental health. Maybe they even have COVID. And, oh, hey, here's a nice bridge for you to go hang out with. So perhaps there should be some kind of appropriate housing for them. They should have this as a right, correct, Larry?
Well, it's a tough sell, because that's not a right that I'm aware of that people who haven't broken the law have.
Wait, we don't have a right for housing in the United States?
Well, I would argue you have the right to pursue housing, but if you look around our cities and even our smaller communities, they're estimated well over a million people that are close to a million people who don't have homes. If you have that right, why are there so many people without homes? Would you be able to just invoke the right and say, give me housing?
Yes, I demand housing, like my $1,200 check.
I think that it's misguided, of course, but the pandemic did not give us a lot of warning. And releasing people when there is no such right that I'm aware of to housing, releasing people, if it's a compassionate thing to do, I just about bet you that most people that were released would prefer you can get more distancing between you and the COVID virus. I'm thinking on the streets than you can in a lockdown in most correctional centers. So I believe that although it's not ideal, it's probably better than being locked away in a correctional facility, wouldn't you think?
Oh, and pretty much anything would be. Maybe not anything. I don't think I would prefer to be in North Korea than to be locked down, just as a thought.
But
there's a,
but gearing
there's a,
up
there's a funny for, paragraph for, in this article.
Go ahead.
About, I don't know, five or six down, I have it highlighted on the stream if you happen to be paying attention at home. It says, housing should not just be a fundamental right for U.S. citizens, which I immediately go, huh? But a guaranteed right for immigrants and residents as well. I do recall, I should have gotten the clip, but of Paul Dubling at one of the conferences, maybe it was Houston, maybe it was North Carolina, when he had drawn all the circles up on the screen, and he says, hey man, I'm sorry, you do not have a right to housing. And I guess before the stream we were talking, like, you probably have the right to not be discriminated against for housing based on race, age, genders, things of that nature. But you are not given a right to housing. So this, I don't know, this is right off the bat kind of not so accurate to come out of the gate.
Well, and I agree with Paul Dubling. The right to housing, in my view, is to not be interfered with by the government to housing. Whatever you would have in the way of opportunity by your economic circumstances, there should be no prohibition of you living wherever opportunity will allow you. And if I were a landlord, I've said previous podcast, if I were still in that business, I would be challenging the big bad government, telling me that I can't have their states where you can't have. You may be running a 300-unit complex, but it may be all under the same street address. It may be 3,200 Briarwood Court Northeast, and there's 170 units in there, and you could only have one person at that address. And of course, there's an argument for interpretation that 3,200 Briarcliff Road, that each apartment number is a separate address, but you end up with having to fight the government over who can live there. And that's not the government's business who can live there, nor is it the government's business who can be in church sanctuaries on worship day. But I don't know that you have a right to any housing. I'm not aware of where that right would exist. You have the right to be free from governmental intrusion.
I understand. I do. But like on the humane side of things, Larry, if we are willing to spend 30, 50, 70 grand a year to keep you inside of a cage, and we're going to say, hey, we have this pandemic happening, and we kick you in the ass and send you out the door and go, hey, come back in 6 months when this thing's over. Welcome to your nearest bridge. We haven't necessarily put the person in a better situation. We've swapped one bad for a different bad.
True, we have. But, you know, the person can refuse release if they like.
Would you like to take a voluntary furlough? No.
Well, I mean, there are rare individuals who do that, but I mean, no. If you're being released prior to the expiration of your sentence, I would generally believe you could refuse that.
That's probably true. Anything else that
stay in the joint if you don't like the options that are available to you. that's gonna cause some heat hate mail to come.
Probably. I can just, like, you know, the food's better. You got, like, sometimes air conditioning, you've got, like, basketball you can play. Like, I mean, that's good times. It's almost like being on a cruise ship.
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far.
All right. So over at OregonLive.com, Oregon's death row will be dismantled by summer. This is crazy, Larry. Though there's 27 people on death row in Oregon, which feels really small. Like, I don't know how many there are in other states. Do you happen to know, is 27 an average number?
Well, it feels low. It would be on the state size, and then the aggressive nature. You'd find a lot more in Texas death row. You'd find a lot more in Georgia's death row.
And they're just going to shut down the condemned unit and move them into general population. That's amazing.
Well, yeah, we would not have even ever had that many on death row in our state because the death penalty was, I'm going to try to be close on my years. I think we went from early 1960s to the year 2000 without having an execution. Even though it was on the books, we didn't do it. And then in the year 2000, 2001, we executed Terry Clark. And he was the last person put to death, which was about 20 years ago. And then we repealed the death penalty in 2009. And therefore, unless the death penalty is reinstated, we'll never have another death row here.
I'm just impressed that somehow the citizens of Oregon have, however long it's been in place, if that's just from their inception till now, that they have decided to dismantle that and just move them into, I guess, life without parole, or maybe even life with parole. I guess if you're on death row, that wouldn't be a parole situation. So these are probably just going to be converted to life without parole.
That would be my guess. And the Nebraska legislature, they repealed the death penalty, and the people reinstated it.
And where was that?
Nebraska.
Okay.
The legislature.
The legislature did it, and the people said no. Put it
the
back.
People, the legislature did an amazing thing. They repealed the death penalty. Now remember, they have just one body. They don't have a bicameral. They have a unicameral. So of their 49 senators, they were able to pass the repeal of the death penalty. They were able to muster the votes to override the veto. And then the people, through the referendum process, reinstated the death penalty. And that's a case of where the people decided that we do control what we want, and we want a death penalty in the state. And the people reinstated it over the objection of the lawmakers, who theoretically represent the people.
Very strange, man. Very strange. There's something in the mindset of the American population that just says we need people to die for shit. It's very strange that we have that mindset.
Now, you can't say that on a family podcast.
This is certainly not a family podcast. And just for the record, I do not ever release this thing with any expectation. Like on the YouTube side of things, there's a thing at the bottom that says, is this intended for children? And I do not check that box. I don't care if minors would listen to it, but it is not intended for children.
Well, we have tens of thousands of minors listening.
I'm sure we do. We are teaching them how to get away with it.
That's correct.
All right, then let's move over to a trio of articles from the Courier Journal. And this is all about no-knock warrants. There was a woman, I guess her name is Breonna, and her name was Breonna Taylor. And there was a no-knock warrant issued against her apartment. Cops come in and she gets shot 8 times, Larry. And then they didn't find the drugs. And I guess the only reason that I'm like even kind of familiar with the concept of no-knock warrants is because we've been having conversation about the thing going on in Cobb County in Georgia. I hope I'm not out of line talking about it in contrast to it, about the hours that they can go visit you and do residence checks. And you and I have spoken then about doing like, well, hey, if it's a no-knock warrant, then you could go in at weird times. But otherwise, you have sort of like normal business hours that you would have to go visit. So the cops go get a no-knock warrant for this lady's house, her apartment, and go beat the door down and shoot her. Like, how?
Well, not having read all the local coverage out of Kentucky, I don't know the details of the case. But what I do know is that it exemplifies what we talk about the people are rising up against this. The people are saying that we're not comfortable with this. And we've even got Rand Paul, senator from Kentucky, that's pontificating about the danger of no-knock warrants. And it feeds right into what I say about if you give police power. If you give police battering rams, they're going to use them. If you give police powers to do what they do, they're going to do it. The way
just
folks
like that tank in Greenville, South Carolina that they got, the mine hunter thing from the military.
The way we control the police is we start reminding the police that we are their boss, not the other way around. And we decide the equipment you use, the rules of engagement, how you conduct yourself when you're on patrol, how you interact with us as citizens. And if we become too rigid, we won't have any police officers and we'll have to back off. But for the police to take the position that they get to decide everything is absurd and ridiculous. And this is an example of where the police were given discretion that they shouldn't have had to do warrants of no knock, and they just, it sounded like reading the story, it's almost as simple as checking a box, request a no knock warrant. There was not enough controls in place to make sure that, that they were really justified in having a no knock warrant.
That is how it sounds. Then they, I think they're talking about one fix would be maybe like the person's supervisor requesting it would have to then give some level of oversight, then add that checkbox and then send it over to the judge to issue the no knock warrant.
Well, it looks like that under the policy that they're going to require the police chief or designee of the police chief.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't like the whole thing of no knock warrants because, yes, you could lose a little bit of contraband, but it may come as a surprise to people. When you start breaking into people's dwellings, you scare people.
What? And, no, stop it.
And the average person at 1 o'clock in the morning is not expecting a battering ram to come through their door. And their reaction is going to be defensive in nature. We don't know what the police allege that they saw this person do that caused them to open fire. But what we do know. Right. Is that it would be normal for a person who hears a loud crash on their door and no announcement that this is the police at 1 o'clock in the morning. What we do know is that the average person would not say, gee, that's got to be my buddy coming over for tea right now. Most people would react in a defensive way.
Yeah, certainly. If you happen to be packing, you would go get your packing equipment and be ready to defend.
Or you would take other measures if you're not even packing. You may be aggressive. You may start shouting. You may start throwing something back. You may start saying, go get away from my door. I mean, you may do any number of things. And since we don't have any video, we don't know what the police were so frightened about. But what we do know is that an escalation happened because of a no-knock warrant and that the police did not have enough evidence to justify it because they didn't find any. That's what we do know.
Right. You know, several months ago, there was the woman in Texas that was just at home. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. The front door was open. Neighbors call, and then they like show up on their porch and shoot her through the window. Not that this is, I mean, that's significantly less extreme, but cops show up and people die. And I don't like it. I do not accept that that is how we live in this society.
Well, I'm not happy that the Supreme Court has decades ago said no knock warrants are okay. And I'm hoping that enough pressure will happen at some point. They will revisit that decision, and maybe we'll get some more precise guidance on when, because the fewer of these we have, and the thing in Cobb County is a good comparison. That's the reason why we don't want law enforcement knocking on people's doors late at night, asking for residency verification, because it scares the people, and it also alarms the neighbors. And these
now,
people
for,
will
for
be.
For clarity, though, let me. I want to make sure that we're clear, though. You're not saying all police are not trustworthy, right?
Of course not.
Okay, I would just want to be clear because you know a comment in chat just came over. No wonder why people don't trust police. I, in general, would be very, very, very apprehensive about trusting them with much of anything. But at the same time, if someone were breaking into my house, I would immediately dial 911.
But you would do that prior to trying to use your own defensive measures?
Yeah, let's see. God, I've given certain different situations, yes and no. I mean, if someone has already breached the threshold, I don't live in a very big place. It's not like I still have 5 minutes once they come through the front door before they get to my bedroom or something like that. So
you don't have a lot,
already be under the pressure as soon as they come in.
Yeah, you don't have a lot of time.
Maybe in your shack you do.
I don't have much time either.
I can see, to me, it feels similar to the government keeping certain programs secret, you know, like the stealth bomber and things like that. It feels like under certain circumstances, there are reasons why we keep things secret. And there would be certain circumstances, very extreme circumstances, where a warrant would get issued and it would be a no-knock warrant. I can see a circumstance, but not at all as a general practice, not anywhere close to it.
Well, I'm assuming this was not a general practice, but I think it got far too easy and people got far too complacent. And that's the problem. If you don't give the police the powers, they will not be as likely to abuse them. Now, police still do things that they're not allowed to do. But the redress and the remedies are greater when they don't have the powers. The police can cite to the Supreme Court saying we can do no-knock warrants, and they go make an application to a local judge, a magistrate official, to ask for the no-knock warrant. If we didn't have that interpretation that no-knock warrants are okay, then the police wouldn't have that power. Then they wouldn't have that temptation, would they?
No, they definitely went. You have to admit, though, Larry, and completely different. I remember seeing video of some, I want to say it was California, so we're looking at this down from a helicopter, and some dudes go on some kind of massive rampage with very heavy weaponry, and they're wearing bulletproof vests and, you know, like even like leg body armor stuff. And the police have their pistols, and they're no match for what these people are carrying. And they're just wreaking havoc somewhere in California. Totally don't remember. Maybe this was in the 80s, maybe in the 90s. So, well, to prevent that from happening, then we have to escalate and make the police able to handle a situation like that. And, you know, then things escalate. Then you end up with people in downtown California with rocket launchers. So then we need tanks and armored personnel carriers to, like, I mean, it's just a nuclear arms race.
Yeah, I remember that video that you're talking about. And there are times when the police find themselves outgunned. And what do you do in any situation when you're outgunned? You back off, and you try to secure the perimeter and keep the people contained in the area where they are, and you try to bring in additional firepower, and you try to do things that wear them down. Passage of time is the greatest friend that law enforcement has, because they have a never ending supply of personnel, and the people that are engaged
go ahead, Larry.
They run out of energy. They run out of food. They run out of water. You can use all sorts of tactics to flush them out. You can play loud music. You can turn on bright lights. You can do all sorts of things once you build that perimeter around them. You don't have to go in with all guns blazing in all situations.
We have an article from Forbes. I don't think we've ever covered Forbes before. Federal judge rejects guilty plea constructed by prosecutors to limit remedies for compassionate release. This one went a little bit over my head. But it seems that there is provisions for it, but plea deals are being constructed to prevent them from being able to use compassionate release later down the line.
And I'm pleased that this judge Breyer, not the Supreme Court justice, but rejected.
I was confused by that at first.
Rejected the plea. Breyer called out assistant U.S. attorney. I can't even begin to pronounce that. You want to take a shot at it down there? Blow fight the right financial advisor. Breyer called out assistant U.S. attorney.
Oh, so, I do remember reading that.
Yeah, that calling her request one that both neatly undoes Congress work and inhumane.
I'm trying to find it. I remember reading it, and I was like, wow, that's a lot of interesting syllables to put together. Almost like the North Carolina person.
Oh, it's way more than that. This is Saleh Jahada paid petita or something like that. Poor Brent is going to have trouble trying to translate that for the podcast.
Yeah, I bet you the transcription is going to be all screwed.
So the judge is saying enough is enough, and we need more judges that are willing to do this and stand up to a prosecutor and say, you know what, if you're going to be that unreasonable, I reject your plea. Now the prosecutor ultimately has the final say. The prosecutor could say, well, Judge, this is the plea, and if you don't want it, I'll dismiss the charges. But the prosecutor's not going to do that in this case, because the prosecutor's trying to make it where the person can't get out. So why would they just want to let the person go? But ultimately, the prosecutor holds more cards than the judge, because if you want to accept my deal, I will cut the person loose.
That's I'm going to take my ball and go home. We don't even have to play baseball anymore. You don't want to play by my rules, I'll just take my ball and go home.
Well, but that's the way it was designed to be. The prosecutor is the representative of the people. The judge is the neutral referee. And the judge, now I've heard that judges, the judge was his name, Sullivan, in the case of the high-profile case with the former administration official. His name's escaping me at the moment. But he's trying to appoint a special prosecutor because the prosecutor wants to dismiss the charges.
Flynn? You're not talking about Michael Flynn, are you?
Yes, I mean, yes.
The case, okay.
Yeah, yes. But ultimately, the prosecutor has the final say. They bring the charges, they decide what to bring, and they decide what to dismiss, and they decide what the outcome of justice should be. So the judge can say, I reject the plea. But if the prosecutor thinks the judge is being unreasonable, and like I say, this is the flip side of this. This is where the prosecutor is being unreasonable. But if a prosecutor wants to give a person parallel example, but if a prosecutor wants a probated sentence and the judge says, I will not accept a plea agreement that has my hands tied for probation, then you request to walk up to the bench and you say, Judge, the people insist that this is the appropriate outcome, and this is all the people will agree to. And if the court can't go along with that, ultimately, the prosecution will have no choice but to dismiss, because we're not going to have this person incarcerated. Ultimately, a prosecutor could do that. They seldom do, but they could. They could say, right. I mean, ultimately, the prosecution can rest their case and say, we don't want to move forward. We're filing a nulli prosequi. We don't want to move forward. And there's not a thing the judge can do about it. They're the referee.
Right. So we've discussed this. So what does the judge have in controlling the schedule? Does the judge and the clerk, do they put the schedule together of when a thing would happen?
What thing?
The trial. The judge controls the scheduling?
Well, in conjunction and consultation with the parties. A more complex case requires more preparation. So a judge for a misdemeanor shoplifting case is not going to have as much complexity involved as a multi-state fraud investigation that has reams and reams and whatever it is that you store on digital devices of discovery. And it's going to require dozens of witnesses to be called. So that's what's done in the pretrial scheduling. The judge looks at the complexity of the case, gets an idea of how many witnesses are going to be called, what the evidence is going to look like, and they agree on timelines for exchanging all the discovery and doing the things in preparation for trial. But ultimately, the judge puts it on a calendar for trial, on a schedule for specific deadlines, and holds the parties to account.
And the defense has no say in when these things go down.
The defense, they're part of that consultation process.
Okay.
Yeah. The judge doesn't do it in a vacuum. The judge asks the defense how many witnesses they're going to call.
But ultimately, what you're driving at is that the prosecutor can just be like, psh, F it, we'll just go home.
If the prosecutor doesn't want to move forward with a case, they have the ultimate power not to.
Yeah.
It's not the judge's call.
Yeah. Huh. I hadn't really considered this.
Now, what makes the Flynn case a little unusual is that the judge had already accepted the plea.
A guilty plea.
Yeah, the judge had already accepted a plea of guilty. And it's rather unusual after a guilty plea has been entered, because both parties have stood and addressed the court. The prosecution and the defense attorney has represented to the court that there has been a statutory violation of law, that upon thorough examination, that this represents the best outcome for the defendant. The defense attorney stand there saying that my client is best served by this plea. The evidence is sufficient. I've apprised him or her of the law, and this is the outcome. And so the judge accepts the plea and puts it on schedule to be sentencing. And then all of a sudden, they say, no, we take it back. We didn't mean it. This is a bit unusual, because all those steps had been completed and a plea had been entered, and everybody had represented that the jurisdiction is satisfied, a crime had been committed, and that this was the outcome. Now, in reality, people plead guilty all the time to things that they probably shouldn't, because the overwhelming power of the state or of the federal government, the overpower of the prosecution, has so many cards.
Sure, but I'm trying to remember, when a witness retracts their statement, retracts their accusation. Is that the right word that I'm thinking of? When they say, hey, the person did it. Oh, wait, never mind. I made that up. You know that they've lied about one thing.
That is correct.
Isn't that, I've been meaning to ask you about this Flynn thing. And not that I'm trying to go down that path, but, you know, hey, send all your hate mail to partisan@registrymatterscast.com, whatever. But he has lied about something, either for or against whatever, because he's now claiming innocence when he pled guilty before.
Well, again, he was advised to plead guilty in lieu of all the analysis that was done by the defense team that they will likely convict you of this. So he represented to the court that he had been apprised and he was pleading guilty. That's what makes this so unusual. But what I was saying is that people are compelled to plead guilty. Why don't you, rather than pleading guilty, when add one thing to when the judge says, are you pleading guilty because you're guilty? Say, judge, I'm actually pleading guilty because my defense attorney has assured me that I will be convicted if I should go to trial based on the evidence they have. But I would prefer not to plead guilty, but I feel like I have no choice.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm going to give you 1,000 years or you can take this 2-year plea deal. Okay, I'll take your 2-year plea deal.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
All right, well, let's move on to like the fun article of the night, because this article is, it's from The Appeal, and it says, the pandemic has prisoners' nerves on edge. Then the power started going out. Larry, I can't think of anything more frightening than it being in prison and having the power go out, which has happened, but it doesn't stay out for very long. Like emergency lights come on. But this is almost like the brownout situation in California. They have water damage in the prison that has messed up the power lines. And they have hours and hours and hours of time per day with the power out that's messed up the water situation, that's messed up showers, man, I am not walking into an enclosed space like a shower with no lights on. I will just have like seriously dirty hands and body or something. I'm not going back there.
Well, prisons are kind of dependent on electrical power for practically everything. I mean, I suppose you can crank open cell doors. There's probably mechanical releases, but every aspect of prison life is from surveillance to everything they do is reliant upon power. So I'm guessing that most correctional facilities of any size have backup power to at least to keep essential systems running.
Yeah, but you end up with a very weird logistics challenge of keeping the generators, which they got to be a pretty big generator system. I've worked at places with big IT shops, and that requires a lot of power. But that's only for a small area. This is for the whole facility would need, not the whole facility, but segments of the entire facility would need these systems to maintain power. It would be frightening, like murder hornet frightening.
It would be indeed. But if you've actually been in a facility where the power failed.
Yeah, but it was just, like a super bad storm, and it took moments before the power kicked on from a generator. And, then the power company gets the power back on. The generator was on for 2 hours, and you just had a minor inconvenience for a period of time.
Well, was it able to sustain all the essential functions, or did it reduce power to things that were not essential? Did it cut power?
TVs turned off or not, but I don't recall it being any sort of pandemic, some sort of pandemonium. Just everyone running around being crazy. I don't recall it being anything of that sort, but I do recall power going out when, I want to say one of the hurricanes rolled through Georgia while I was gone. And, there was something that happened, and I don't remember anything significant coming from it. I think the power went out briefly.
Well, who needs electrical power? That's a luxury that prisoners ought not have.
I know, right? Most of your life was spent without electricity, right?
A good part of it, yes. Sure did.
Also over at The Appeal, we have Louisiana women incarcerated for defending themselves against abusive partners seek clemency amid COVID-19 panic. What is this liberal mumbo jumbo stuff you've got going on here?
Well, I've always felt without any proof that spouses, especially females, when they kill the abuser, is more likely to be a male. But there are men who are abused by spouses, so I don't want to make it sound like it doesn't happen. But I feel like that we're so shocked as a society when they assert this as being a reaction towards abuse that we really throw the book at them. And this one's been in prison since a very long time, decades now. It says on September 5th, 1986, which is, 34 years ago?
Yep.
We're having drinks at a bar and got into an argument he was stabbed in the chest. But if there's anything that prison can do for her, it's already done it. And this clemency application is on the governor's desk. And he's never presented himself as being the this is John Bel Edwards of Louisiana. He's never said he's the liberal California, but he has presented himself as being the face of reform and change. And this would be an example for him to do something courageous and release this person. The parole board, the system has recommended. It's just waiting for him. It looks like it's been on his desk now for some time. In August 2019, the Louisiana Board of Pardons and Parole recommended a commutation of Gibson's sentence. The board's recommendation is awaiting a signature of Governor Edwards. So he's had it on his desk for a long time now.
Right. Hey, and I'm reading there at the top that they went to a bar in Kenner in 1986. Fast forward 3 years, I may have been at that bar in Kenner, Louisiana.
Well, what do you think about that bar? Was it a good place to get into a brawl?
This place probably, if I'm not mistaken, it was called The Place. I was in a band, and that was one of the places that we played. It was called The Place.
So, in April, go ahead.
No, I was nothing. Go.
In April, Edwards did commute the sentence of Sabrina Parks, who had served 40 years, nearly 40 years, of a life sentence for second-degree murder. And Parks now has long maintained that she killed her husband after he abused her for years. And this is one of those things where it's difficult to know when someone says, I did it because of abuse, because most abusers don't operate out in public. You don't see that side of them. And very few people have the documentation where there's conclusive proof beyond a reasonable doubt that they were getting abused.
I think the article that you couldn't open from the Washington Post is very similar. It's Maryland's longest serving female prisoner has COVID-19. And the reason why she was there is that she got convicted of first degree murder, and she was locked up when she was 18, and she's now 60. It is a long time. But here's what bothers me about this, Larry. She's been granted parole twice by the Maryland Parole Commission, and two governors have rejected her release. Why?
Well, then we get to be bipartisan, because John Bel Edwards is a Democrat, and the current governor of Maryland is Republican, but the previous governor was not Republican. Oh. So that means that both parties have done the same thing.
Right. I was wondering if you were going to go down the path of a Republican can do criminal justice reform and not get thrown under the bus, but a Democrat can, if they do the same thing, then they get thrown under the bus.
It's less likely that a Republican would take a hit politically. It just doesn't resonate. It's the reality of politics. If you talk about being tough on national security, no one would ever challenge your credentials. You could look back at the United States and our various treaties of starting with the Nixon administration in 1972, that we had the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaties, and then we had the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaties. And then we had I forgot which treaty it was that Bush did, but Nixon, and then followed by Reagan with Strategic Arms Reductions. Those things, had Democratic presidents done those agreements, they would have been vilified because the Russians, the bear bombers, would be coming in here and they would be taking us over. But they have the credentials. I mean, Nixon railed against communism all of his political career through his serving in Congress and through his vice presidency. And he was able to be Mr. Security. So it's just the reality of how politics works. And I always remind people, I don't make the rules. I'm just telling you that a Republican is not going to be vilified for certain things because they have the credentials to be perceived as they would never do it. A Republican governor is not going to release a tyrant of criminals. They're just not going to do that because we can trust them. Democrats are known to be in favor of criminal behavior and cutting everybody loose and having unsafe communities and having pandemonium because they think they're going to get votes. And you can make that case against Democrats, and Republicans do it quite well, but you can't flip it over. A Democrat can't go out and say this Republican is being soft on crime. It just doesn't. It doesn't. No one believes it.
Tell me about this, though, and I'm sure you can't see it, but it says in one of the paragraphs, it says about 50 lawmakers signed a letter sent to Hogan with the request to release this woman. What would it take to get that number of politicians to back you in getting your sentence? Is she getting it commuted? Is she just however she's being released? I don't know the detail there, but it would take a lot of energy to get 50 politicians to sign onto it.
It would be a huge undertaking to get. Those people are risking political blowback if something were to go wrong. If she were released, would be released, there would be potential consequences. So that is an amazing accomplishment. But when you've been in prison for 40 years since you were 18 years old, I think that she deserves a second chance, regardless of whether she was abused or not. It's not even relevant in my analysis.
No, and I just, it's almost cruel. Like, I don't want to make the even sound like I'm making the suggestion she should stay in, but it's almost cruel to let her out. Like, the world is a radically different place than it was 40 years ago. Well, there would have to be a long segment of reentry classes just to, like, hey, this is like, hey, we used to have VCRs. We don't have them anymore. We have these little things that you plug into your TV and you can just watch all of the television all over the whole world just magically over the internet. This person may never have even seen the internet or sent an email message.
I'm doubtful that she has. I doubt she would know how to pump gas. I doubt she would know how to go through a grocery checkout line, self-serve. She wouldn't know how to.
It would be, it's almost cruel. It'd be cruel to take, you know, somebody living out in like some tiki hut in Zimbabwe and bring them to the United States with all that we live. Like, it's just, it would be a very weird situation.
I doubt she could make a telephone call. She'd be looking for a rotary or a push button phone.
And she'd be trying to call Aunt Belle at the central dispatch or something.
And I'm exaggerating a little bit. I mean, she sees TV and she knows that there are cell phones. But as far as knowing the intricacies, and unless she's been able to smuggle one in prison, she doesn't know a lot about how the communications have changed and how we move documents around and cloud-based storage. And I mean, the things that I wouldn't have even dreamed of 10 years ago we're doing now.
Where is it? You know what? That's going to have to be a Patreon extra. I got to get you to explain what cloud storage is.
I can't explain it. I just use it. I can't explain it though. But it's neat. It's neat stuff.
That would be a really short Patreon extra then if you could do that. I don't know. I just use it.
Yep. I don't need to know. I just know that in the old days, all the stuff that Narsil does, I couldn't keep in this building, and I keep it now. Well, everything we tease about the global headquarters, we've got a banker box that I put Narsil stuff in that I feel like I really must keep track of. And most of it's stored on the cloud. We don't keep anything anymore.
I'm going to have to get you to develop about a 5-minute long rant about what cloud storage is just to try to put the pieces together. That would be fun, Larry. That's an idea. All right. Well, let's move on. We have the Star Tribune, and this is a University of Minnesota law professor falsely accused of rape wins $1.2 million defamation judgment. That is a lot of money, but for a false allegation. And the person, like, went to town on it and said that they had toothaces, their teeth were knocked out, and then they ended up with some sort of colon problems. And no one ever produced any medical records to support the claim. I guess they just went along with it. Like, hey, this guy obviously did these things.
That's the tragedy of where we've evolved in terms of the, I keep going back to the Me Too movement, but unfortunately that's the tragedy of shifting the burden and no longer assuming anything. When we assume people are guilty because they're accused and we place the burden upon them and we take fundamental rights away from them, that's how we end up with a situation here. And I don't think if you were falsely accused of a serious sexual offense, I don't think you would view $1.2 million as being too much if you were hauled away in handcuffs, put in jail, your career destroyed, your reputation destroyed. I think you would probably figure that was a reasonable settlement.
I think so. But the lead investigator never got the dental or medical records until after Parisi was charged. So here the guy is formally charged, like mugshot, perp walk, all of those things, spends 3 weeks in jail, during which time his mother passes away, couldn't attend the funeral and all that stuff. All over, it seems like mishandled prosecution side of things.
Well, and again, I find myself occasionally defending prosecutors, and ultimately they have the power to make choices, but they're under extreme pressure from society and from all these advocates. I mean, the victims' advocate movement and they're constantly on prosecutors. Why haven't you filed? Just think back 20 years ago. I think JonBenet Ramsey was about 1999. If you want to do a quick Google and see how close I am. The pressure that DA's office in Boulder was under to arrest the Ramseys, the family. That was unbelievable, and the remarkable thing was that the DA, Alex Hunter, and his chief deputy, Peter Hofstrom, both said, no, we're not going to. We do not have the evidence.
Right.
But the evidence is no longer required. It's supposed to be, according to the victims, we just simply take their word. We believe them, and we don't re-victimize them by bothering to go through all the hoops. I mean, dental records, what do you mean by dental? That hurts my feelings. What, my dental records?
What year did you say?
I think it was 99.
She died in 96. So, I mean, I'll 96. Let it go, man. You're 3 years off.
Uh-oh. That's awful. My memory's getting really bad.
Tell me this. If every time there was a false allegation and this level of settlement were awarded, would prosecutors get gun shy against, would they make sure that they have all their I's and dots and T's and crosses, all that stuff to before they bring any sort of charges against somebody?
I don't think so. I don't think it would have much impact because the money's not coming out of their budget. It's not impacting them directly.
It comes out of the state's budget, just like their general fund or something?
Well, it's no telling where it came from because there's different ways that the university, this was the university that paid it. I can't open the article anymore, but this was a settlement. But unless the prosecutor's office were to actually pay it, and they don't, and nor should they, in my opinion, but unless it's coming out of their budget, what's going to change their mind is when the voters demand that you don't bring innocent people into the criminal justice system, or we will repudiate you at the polls if you do that. That's what would change the prosecutor. But the fact that that lawsuits are settled, I don't think it's going to have any meaningful impact on a prosecutor.
You don't think eventually, like, I don't know if it's the governor, somebody that does budgets, be like, look, guys, I need you to chill out on all of these allegations. Like, make sure that you do your due. Like, that conversation would never exist from maybe the state level attorney general down to the prosecutors.
If the settlements got so frequent and they were coming from publicly provided funds, possibly, but like I said, I don't know where the source of the funds are. Oftentimes you've got insurance carriers, like everybody's going after the Catholic Church. They're going after the deep pockets of the Catholic Church and their insurance carriers for their civil liability. And so it depends on where the money's coming from. But as long as it's not directly out of the prosecutor's pockets or their budget, not their personal pockets, but as long as it's not coming out directly out of the prosecutor's office, their attitude is not going to change until the people demand that they change. And the people are not going to likely demand that they change because we are a punitive people. We like for people, prosecutors, when you run on the platform of being easy, it generally doesn't win, with a few exceptions.
I understand where you're going with that. All right. Well, now that we've taken all of that time for all of those things, let's move over to what would be the feature segment of the evening, which is the John Doe versus David B. Rausch. Did I pronounce that right, do you think?
I think that's close enough.
This happens to be a very longtime listener of the podcast who demanded that he remain anonymous, even though I know who you are, but I will never tell anybody who you are. And he was sentenced and convicted of something like a while ago, and then they changed the rules. So then he filed a suit, and he's been awarded and not awarded his claim. So I now leave you the floor.
Well,
how'd I do?
Thank you. I wrote an analysis that's in the process of being edited, and I did a lot of cutting pasting from the 14,000 word opinion, and I've reduced it down to about 1,600 words that are going to be what we distribute to the public. But I think it's very fascinating because the things that I've preached for so long are all in this decision, and it would be just a classic read of how the registry has evolved through the years. So I've got that in the analysis. So this case, I think I normally make appellate predictions, and I always think everything's going to be appealed. I'm not sure this one will be. The mindset of the state is to appeal everything, but this case is so different because the court made it clear that it only applies to him, and sure, it's a very limited decision. And they didn't even take him off the registry per se. They're not issuing an order that he be removed from the registry. They are ordering that the state not enforce registration against him. And that's what I would really like to talk to his attorney about, because that really fascinated me. We're going to say the state can't enforce the registry against you, but we're not going to order that you be removed from the public registration, which all throughout the opinion, the court recognizes how disastrous that is for the individual. But going through this thing, the registration as it existed in Tennessee, he pled guilty in 1999 to 7 counts of attempted aggravated sexual battery involving 3 minor victims in Anderson County, Tennessee. But prior to getting out, the law changed. They changed the law from having SORMA to having SORVTA, the sexual offender registration, violent, whatever it is, they adopted a new act, and he became a lifetime registrant while he was in prison. He would not have been had things stayed the same. So he became a lifetime registrant while he was in prison. They changed the rules. You like that, don't you, when they change the rules in the middle of the stream?
That's the best. It's just amazing when the, like, you think you've got these rules, but wait, no, we've got other rules for you. I was, I think I found somewhere in there, like maybe in the conclusion, maybe. I found something. So he got part of it that was granted in part, and part of that was denied. He was to his First and 14th Amendment claim. So first is like freedom of speech and assembly and all that stuff. What's the 14th Amendment?
Don't ask me. I don't know anything about the Constitution.
I think that's equal protection, if I'm not mistaken.
Due process, and I so think. This, but anyway.
Okay.
Go ahead.
But so he had the quote-unquote civil regulatory scheme extended further onto whatever he originally signed on to. And he said, I'm not putting up with that. Goes and sues. And so can you articulate what he was granted and what he wasn't by chance?
Well, I think I'll do my best. And then, like I say, the written part will follow the podcast. He sued because he was arrested for violating the failure to report all of his internet monikers and ID stuff that he in 2017. And he maintained his innocence, but he entered a guilty plea agreement because they reduced it down to an attempt, which brought it down to a misdemeanor, and it saved him from a felony-level conviction. But he filed this lawsuit after that because he figured that this would be a recurring problem, I'm guessing. But I think that this presents an opportunity to talk about summary judgment, because part of what went wrong in his case, to the extent that you can say anything went wrong, was that the case was decided by summary judgment. And on my analysis, if you want to open it up, there's a section called motions for summary judgment. In May of 2019, both parties filed a motion for summary judgment. And then I cut and pasted from the court. Summary judgment under Rule 56 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure is proper if the movant, meaning the motion maker, shows that there's no genuine dispute as to any material fact, and that the movant, the motion maker, is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. The moving party bears the burden of establishing that no genuine issues of material fact exist. And then this is the part that confuses people. All facts and all inferences to be drawn therefrom must be viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. The court's function at this point of summary judgment is limited to determine whether sufficient evidence has been presented to make the issue a fact proper question for the fact finder. The court does not weigh the evidence or determine the truth of the matter. And this is where everyone gets hung up in Smith versus Doe, which was decided by summary judgment. The court was forced because of the way the case was decided. The facts were stipulated to by the parties when they moved for summary judgment. You're saying there's nothing in dispute. And the state of Alaska had said, if we were to go to trial, Your Honor, we would show that recidivism is off the chart. Well, in summary judgment, the court is not allowed to get into that. The court's function is limited in summary judgment. They do not weigh evidence or determine the truth of the matter, because you parties have already done that. You've said that there's nothing for me to determine.
Can we get people out of that?
That's what I don't know how to put you people in here.
and people have decided to not do these things.
Yeah, and then it goes on to say, nor does the court search the record to establish if there is a breadth of genuine issue of material facts. So the court doesn't go say, well, gee, even though the parties agree that there's nothing here factually for us to determine, I'm going to go looking and see if I can find something. There must be something that would require a trial. So in this case, to the extent that anything went wrong, it would be that it was decided on summary judgment. So therefore, an evidentiary record dealing with some of the assertions that were being made wasn't developed. And the defenses that the state offered to those assertions had to be accepted as true because we didn't have a trial. So, but then if you go down to the next page, the court does a brilliant job of explaining that the court acknowledged the Supreme Court has upheld retroactive application of sex offender registries. And then they talk about Smith versus Doe. And I agree with that. That's exactly the Supreme Court has to. Likewise, the Sixth Circuit has previously upheld Tennessee sex offender registry against similar challenges, and they list all the cases. And then they say, but first, SORFTA has grown in layers as the Tennessee General Assembly has expanded the scope of restrictions and the content of its reporting requirements. Second, the contours of the Sixth Circuit precedent have changed in intervening years since they last decided the Tennessee cases. And people need to pay careful attention to that. Go ahead and admit that the Supreme Court got it right in Smith versus Doe. The registry as it existed at that point did not inflict punishment. Thus, it was not unconstitutional to be applied retroactively. Get over it. That's long ancient history, almost 20 years ago. Let's talk about today, which is what they did in this case. They talked about today, and the court goes into an analysis about what has changed in registration and all the enhancements and all the disabilities and restraints. And I highlighted in the actual opinion, which I cut it down from double space into single pages, got it down to 31 pages, so it doesn't look so onerous to read. But I highlighted all throughout the opinion about how they concluded that this violates ex post facto because it has exponentially exploded in terms of the requirements. Tennessee lawmakers, other state lawmakers, if you would just stop while you're ahead, while the courts have upheld your registries, stop. And you wouldn't be in this position because now there's going to be more litigation. This is not going to be the last case. This will not be the last case. After this judge has done this, there will be other people who will come back who've had registration applied to them retroactively or enhanced, and they're going to come after it. They're going to go after it. And there's a good chance they'll win. And that's what would cause me to think the court might appeal because of they're going to see the cascading consequences of what's going to happen.
Wow. All right. I don't know that I want to dig like another hour into this, but it seemed like there would be a lot more that we could talk about. So, like all of the people in Tennessee that had, you know, sentenced in 2000 and then all these additional things could follow this to some degree of a template and go kick them in the nuts.
Well, they were going to continue to enhance the registry until finally the courts erect a wall and say, this is like they did in Doe versus Snyder. You can't do these things retroactively. And Michigan is continuing to fight as I anticipated they would. And I think that if I had to flip a coin, it's 50-50, but I think these people will appeal because they're going to see a cascade of cases coming at them if they don't. But it's a great read for people to get into. Some of his claims were denied. He tried to allege void for vagueness, and that was denied. He tried to allege that the internet restrictions violated his freedom of speech. But since they were granting him relief on other grounds, the courts take a limited view that we don't need to resolve that question because it can't be enforced against you. So the internet, whether that violates the Constitution and chills free speech, that's an argument for another day. But this is a beginning in Tennessee. I'm so excited. I'm palpitating. That finally something has happened good in Tennessee. We've got all these people, regulars, that come in here to the chat room, and they say, how come nothing's happened in Tennessee? Well, apparently something is happening in Tennessee.
Yeah. This is interesting. I think I can see why the Tennesseans would be scared of what could be coming down the pike. So scream it from the rooftops that there is something in Tennessee that maybe people can latch onto.
Well, I was
why
just
can't
scrolling.
They just stop, Larry?
The victims' advocates won't let them. When the victim's advocate comes to see a lawmaker and they say we should do these things, it's very hard for you to look at somebody who has the potential, some organization has the potential to cause you to get dozens or hundreds of emails and phone calls and say, nope, not going there. Because not only are you going to get those emails, you're also going to be vilified in the media because they're going to go screaming to the media saying that this person is for the sex offenders. Yeah. And it's just it's not realistic. They're not going to be able to stop until they're stopped. And even stopping when they're stopped is going to be hard for them because the public continues to demand this.
We are a great place, man. Great place. I do have what, are we done with that before we bounce on?
Well, I was scrolling through to see if there's any points I wanted to go into that were worthy of note. And I think it's probably just better if people read the analysis and read the highlighted decisions, because it's a very lengthy decision, 16,000 words.
That is a lot. Well, then we'll move on. And Josh is a frequent guest here from Michigan, and he wanted me to push out something. He's hosting an event on Zoom on Thursday, the 28th at noon, at 12 o'clock p.m. It is a panel, Sex Offender Registries Promise to Keep Survivors and Communities Safe by Limiting Where People Convicted of Sex Offenses Can Live, Work, Learn, and Volunteer. It requires them to publicly register where they reside and earn a living. But studies show these laws fail to keep us safe, while they create an underclass of people who struggle to find a good job and safe place to live. Learn why registries have failed and the movement to end them. It's got a panel of guests from Miriam Aukerman, who's the senior staff attorney. She was the attorney that led the charge to challenge the registry in Michigan. There's a Judith Levine, who's a journalist, and a Vincent Schiraldi, I guess is what that was, and he's a senior research scientist at Columbia University. Josh is the policy analyst for Safe and Just Michigan. He's the moderator of this panel. So you can find a link to that in the show notes. It's an easy bit.ly link, and you can join that on Thursday at noon o'clock. And I wanted to pass that along for our people. This podcast will get released on Tuesday at midnight, so that you'll have about 70 hours or something like that before the event shows up on Zoom on Thursday.
Well, thank you for that.
Yeah. Josh is a good dude. He's a pretty smart cat. He's the only person I know of so far, Larry, that can go toe-to-toe to you with and debate with you, I suppose.
I wouldn't go that far that he's the only person.
Well, he's the only one I know. He's the only one that's come on the podcast. The other people, like, they put their tail between their legs and they go cry in a corner and wet themselves.
Oh, that's probably a little embellishment there, but okay.
Someone asked about the transcripts, and I wanted to definitely just make sure to tell you that if you head over to registrymatters.co, there is a transcript there on every show dating back to like 50 or something. And so there's show notes for all of the episodes, and then there's also a transcript. And now we even have a human editing the automated one to clean anything up, to make sure that the names are spelled right and all that. But be sure to go check out the show notes and transcriptions at registrymatters.co. Larry, I think we're done.
I think we have to make an announcement. We're going to have a special guest next week that people are going to come from coast to coast to listen to.
They should, because he's in the middle of the coast to coast. Can you tell me, he's from Minnesota, right?
Minnesota, yes.
Do you remember the person's name?
I do.
Oh, tell me the person's name.
Christian.
All right, we're going to have Christian on. He left a voicemail maybe a month ago saying that we should have people from around the country come on the show. And I'd been thinking about doing that. And so he's going to join us next week, barring any complications. But that'll be, I think, the 30th.
And we've had some guests on. We're open to doing more. So if this turns out that people enjoy it, we'll judge it by the numbers. We'll probably look at doing it more frequently.
Yeah, thumbs up or thumbs down. If you don't like it, thumbs it down.
And I would probably, for YouTube, I should write a response, probably a little bit less lengthy than what I said on the podcast, but we probably ought to respond when we get comments. That would probably encourage more traffic to people. So
I'd definitely.
So
sort of the whole engagement model, Larry. Well, I'm going to run through all the things really quick. Like I said before, you can find the show notes and all that at registrymatters.co. You can call and leave voicemail 747-227-4477. Email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, we love all of our listeners, but our patrons make this whole thing possible and support us with a couple bucks here and there, some of them way more than that. And you can do that over at patreon.com/registrymatters. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart, and I know that Larry feels the same, that people would extend some financial support to keep up with what we're doing here. And thank you so very much. You can join in live on the Discord server. There's a link in the show notes. And find us on YouTube and Spotify and Google Play. You can use your Amazon Echo devices. I'm not going to say the A word, or mine will fire up and start talking back to me. But you can find us all over the place and subscribe. And that is all I got, Larry. And I thank you so much, as always. You are an amazing amount of knowledge and information to share.
Thank you, and good night.
Take care. Bye-bye.